This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
All good.
Pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's it going with you, Nate?
It's good. I, Dr. Lyle, I vote we skip the small talk and get straight to the questions again.
Jesus.
That is well done.
No comment. No comment.
Well, we got to ask, well, how are your dogs, Jen? Let's check in with the kids.
Oh, my God. Oh, no, let's not. Oh. Let's not.
All right.
The dogs are fine.
All right.
But it's meaningless knowing that you don't love them.
Oh, man. Oh, well, this is kind of like trying to do chit-chat with Alan. You know what I mean? When Alan gives you a little chit chat line, you know this is like totally bogus. Oh my goodness! All right, well, I am curious. How's your weather up there in Seattle?
Oh, it's brightened up. It's been pretty miserable, but it's gotten better in the last couple of days. Warm enough to have dinner outside and, you know, go on walks around the water, and it's not quite as brutal and. The relentless rain has let up a little bit. So this is my recollection of what happens around this time of year. And then you get slammed again. And then it finally brightens up a little bit.
Yeah,
I was all excited to this is the perfect time to go up to the University of Washington has all these glorious cherry trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking online to see, you know, when's the best weekend to go. Yeah. And the website is very much, it says, you know, for the second year in a row, the University of Washington is officially recommending that everybody enjoy our beautiful cherry trees virtually.
Oh,
so
brother.
Don't come walk around and breathe in the nice fresh air and get some time outside in the sun. And, you know, it's pretty, even in the busiest years with the busiest weekends, mm-hmm. It's never shoulder to shoulder. You know,
right.
You've got little crowds around certain trees, but I don't think it would be anything that they couldn't manage. So I was a little disappointed to see that for sure.
Oh, brother. I'd go anyway. What are they going to walk you off the place?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, it's a huge campus.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a concentration of the most cherished, you know, the fanciest, oldest trees that people cross continents and oceans to come see every year.
Yeah.
But there's beautiful, you know, cherry blossoms all over the campus. So I don't have to go necessarily to the quad and join in the masses. I can just enjoy the campus in general. So I plan to do that and stay properly socially distanced from all in the process.
Oh, for God's sakes.
I was at the grocery store the other day and I saw there was like three or four ATMs all next to each other. And they had those, you know, the X's where you're supposed to stand 6 feet away from each other. Mm-hmm. But the ATMs are like horizontally, they're close together. So, I was just thinking, can you imagine how many more people would have died of COVID if COVID knew how to travel horizontally? I mean, it's just really.
Good thing it doesn't know.
Well, yeah, that's well said, Nathan. I thank goodness. Oh my God!
I saw something on Twitter that, you know, one of the so-called technological innovations has been these sort of QR codes on menus. You see these if you go out to restaurants where, you know, now you know you're no longer handed a filthy, contaminated physical menu. You're asked to scan the menu and watch it on your
view it on your own filthy contaminated
phone,
right?
Which everybody's phones are completely disgusting. We know this, but at least it's your own filth. You know?
Yeah.
lyrics mostly. But there were some observations about how, you know, how this is the kind of technology that is more difficult for seniors to, you know, learn quickly. It's sort of like disproportionately difficult. And so how many wait staff are hovering closely over seniors trying to, you know, just order whatever they want off the menu and having much more proximity to them than they otherwise would have if they just had the big filthy plastic menu. So these sort of unintended consequences that are impossible to track in a meaningful sort of way across the population, but interesting to think about. Going to go see the cherry trees.
Go see the cherry trees, for God's sakes.
But that's at the threshold of my kind of, you know, I think that preventing outdoor activities gets into the realm of a little absurd.
Totally absurd. There's not a single shred of evidence that COVID has ever been hopped outdoors in an outdoor type situation from person to person. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're 2 feet away from them screaming at a football game, that's a different story. But just in general outdoors, I mean, it's ludicrous. So, oh well, almost done. In case people didn't know, you can go look at the little curves on the Worldometer website, and you can see that COVID is now tailing off to a very small percentage of what it, you know, was even 2 months ago. Well, 2 months ago was COVID's peak in the U.S. of a major third wave, which was the big one, and so we're now down to something on the order of, I think, maybe below 20% of that. I think the peak was 300,000 a day. We're now looking at about 50,000 cases a day and dropping, you know, pretty quickly. So almost done. Almost done, everybody. The California, they're seeing about 1,000 cases a day, which means there's probably 5,000 a day. So that means, you know, in the next week, there'll be probably 25 to 35 real 1,000 cases as it's tailing off. So with 35 or 40 million people, that your odds of getting COVID if you're out and about generally in California is in the next week is about 1 in 1,000. So we're almost there, almost ready to get reasonable.
Well, it's about time.
It's about time. You got it. All right. Well, let's see what we got, Nathan.
All right, cool. All right, now I'm ready. All right. Dear Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle, it's interesting. This question actually has Dr. Hawk first, as I guess it apparently should be. So, you know, some of the other ones are just dear doctors. But dear Dr. Hawk, dear Dr. Lyle, is it possible to have a personality that is not a good fit for a long-term committed relationship?
Yes. No, go ahead.
I mean, really, pretty much. Yes. The answer is yes. We just love to hear ourselves talk. So we'll spend, you know, another 45 minutes explaining why. But if you're just interested in the answer, the answer is yes.
Yeah, I hit the buzzer first. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's hear it, Nathan.
All right. 200 points to Dr. Lyle. Okay, so I'm not sure if I'm too high maintenance. I'm moderately agreeable, moderately conscientious, very open to new experience, moderately extroverted, and moderately unstable. In my last relationship of 3.5 years, he left me because he said I was not stable and that we were not moving forward. And in my current relationship of 2 years, I have felt driven to bend over backwards to spend time with my mate, even when it meant not getting enough sleep or exercise or not maintaining a balanced lifestyle. When I'm in the midst of the relationship, I sense that things feel off balance. And yet, I feel driven and like I have little control of my time and my choices. But my partners tend to be sweet, caring, stable, and on the needier side. Ultimately, I fear that if I don't make time for my partner at the expense of my true desires and needs, then he will get mad and leave. In my current relationship, I have finally started saying what is true for me. For example, I don't want to sleep over because I don't sleep well because my partner snores. But I anticipate the relationship will not endure if I continue to take care of myself and say what is true for me in this way. I also doubt my ability to actually and consistently stick with myself and say what I need. I've been in therapy with the same therapist for the past 7 years during these two relationships. My therapist thinks my problem is that I do not put myself on the map or follow my compass in most areas of my life. And she continues to tell me to practice thinking about and speaking in new ways that express my true desires. This has felt impossible to me. I feel like I'm stupid, and it is as if I can't comprehend the advice she is giving me. It makes sense intellectually, but I can't do anything with her advice. How do I get out of this cycle of denying my needs in order to be with a partner? Is it possible I'm simply not agile enough to balance the demands of adult life and the demands of a romantic partnership? How might I make better choices in order to work with my personality? Thank you for all the wisdom and insights you share on your podcast and on your website. It's truly eye-opening and life-enhancing.
Yeah, this will be entertaining. You know, nothing like having a nice big fastball thrown right down the middle of the plate for Jen Hawk. It's just great to watch. All right, okay, have fun with it. Well, I'll just chime in as I feel like it. Go ahead, Jen.
This is Doug's way of just, you know, handing it over to me so he can go hang out with his cats. I think this is what's going on here. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of detail describing your particularity in this question. And at first blush, when I hear this particular type of detail, you are, you know, you're describing yourself as moderately agreeable, and you're hitting the limits of your agreeableness when it comes to quote unquote setting these boundaries in this relationship. So of course, every therapist you're ever going to go to is all about these ridiculous phrases, following your inner compass, putting yourself on the map, setting these boundaries, when really you have some kind of unusual needs that are, your happy equilibrium in a romantic relationship is not very typical for the species. That doesn't make it abnormal. The abnormal is normal, as Robert Plomin tells us. It just means that these are kind of this is where you're comfy. This is what you need. You need to sleep on your own. You can't sleep next to somebody who snores. You have this high need for independence. You have all of these other things that are sort of not very typical. They're not the rom-com standard of what most people expect and most people in the middle of the bell curve want from a relationship. So this is just a question of you coming to terms with the fact that, you know, you're at some kind of intersection in all of your relationships with these sort of unusual-ish needs, or at least, you know, needs to a certain degree that are unusual for the population, and you know a relationship that can accommodate those or not. So if you're somebody who is wired to, you need a lot of time alone, you want to have your own space, you're feeling very independent, I'm very sympathetic to all those things. I am that way myself, and I have run into situations and relationships where I've had somebody who's wanted a lot more of that togetherness in a way that makes me feel kind of what you're describing, where you're not able to have a balanced life in the same kind of way. I've never forfeited sleep or some of these other things that you're talking about, but maybe I'm a little more disagreeable than you are. But I've definitely been in a situation where I have felt like I'm in a relationship where somebody wants things from me, wants certain kinds of behaviors that I am just not really constitutionally suited to provide. But that's a moving target based on who you're in a relationship with as well. So if you're with somebody who can work with you in an active negotiation about what it looks like for both of you to experience a good equilibrium in the relationship and to be able to find that balance and have time alone, have time together, spend that time in ways that's satisfying to both of you. That kind of thing gets a lot easier than if you're with somebody who is more disagreeable, more demanding of lots of things that you don't want to give. And that can turn into a much lousier back and forth. So I would say, I mean, it's hard to kind of tell how you're feeling about your current partner just in general. I'm not getting a lot of sense from the question about that. This sounds more like you feel you you can't spend your time in the way that you want to spend your time. And I, you know, what your therapist is trying to get at with putting yourself on the map and following your own inner compass is, and that you were having difficulty doing, is that you're perceiving that it's just too high cost in this relationship to assert those things. And so you're hitting that limit of your agreeableness. You feel if you actually tell your partner, hey, you're snoring a lot and I don't want to be in this room with you, I need to sleep on my own, that essentially raises your cost in the context of the relationship, and you don't want to do that because you don't want to lose the relationship. So these are things that you just have to do. You have to come into this interaction with, you know, an honest market rate of what it costs to be in a relationship with you. Otherwise, it's not going to be sustainable in the long term. So this is one of these places where I'm a big fan of, it goes by different names, but I love calling it the State of the Union. Like a weekly or a monthly check-in about this kind of stuff, where you have a designated space and time and container for conflict in the relationship, where it gets depersonalized and you can actually bring these things up, and it's not an attack on the other person. You're not going after their character. You're being very careful not to make sweeping statements and hold the other person responsible for your happiness. You're just saying, this X is not working for me. How can we solve this problem together? It's you and me together against this issue. It's not me against you. And by designating specific time for that conversation, that can be much more productive than just letting it build up and stewing on it, like it sounds like you are in a habit of doing. So that's my take on it, as somebody who's been in sort of a similar situation before. But I'm sure Doug can, now that he's back from his cats, can weigh in as well.
Yeah, I just like watching, you know, Mike Cuellar pitch. You guys don't know who that is?
I don't know who that is.
Somebody knows, okay? The unbelievable. Every psychotherapist and budding psychotherapist in the world should listen to that, you know, 5 or 7 minutes. It's just freaking brilliant. It's unbelievable. I never heard anything like that from a psychotherapist in my life that could.
It's very sweet. Yeah, it's true. It's just, this is what it is. This is just this is the situation. It's, I don't,
everybody, just go try to hit Cuellar. Good luck to you. This is what Jen is she's laid out, like, I think every detail in this thing. The I have a couple of simplistic points that don't add much. It's more for a knuckle dragger way of looking at it. A knuckle dragger way of looking at it is she had, I forget what you just called it. You know, you're going to do the State of the Union. We're going to look at this thing, all this freaking beautiful detail. I call it a buffer zone approach. And a buffer zone approach is, if you're not willing to take less than $20 an hour for the job, then you tell them, hey, I'm not willing to take less than 22. Okay. So you try to like put a barrier out there a little bit that gives you a little buffer zone. And so when they push into it, if we feel that there's going to be conflict, which the person obviously feels that there are conflicts, that's what you do. So, I mean, that's one way that you can, I know this is, it's slightly non-golden play, it's slightly manipulative, but depending upon who you are, it may be a way for you to jerry-rig a relationship in a way that works. So if you really want to be, you know, going to yoga class 3 times a week, you explain that you have yoga class 4 times a week and it's really something that's important to you. That way, when you sacrifice one, you've already sacrificed.
This is spoken like a man who's been negotiating professionally with Alan Goldhammer for decades on end. Learn the hard way.
All right. The other thing that I would say is that another part of this is that life kind of really works like this. So we can try the buffer zone, but it's, you know, it's got limited utility, because the truth of the matter is that, if, first of all, some conflict in relationships is just fine. People don't flip out over conflict. question is, how big is the conflict? And so it's just an overall CB that's involved. And Jen's just talked about, obviously, the best way to manage this conflict is to have a depersonalized recurrent process. If that's something that, you know, individuals need, based on who those people are as personalities, and therefore how much conflict seems to inherently arise out of that relationship. The I'm a conflict avoider, so the State of the Union gets foisted on me.
Somebody has to foist it. And with the thing is, like, this is like eating healthy food. You never want to do it. You know, it never feels like, quote unquote, the right thing to do. The vegan donut feels like the right thing to do. But this is the way that you beat your genes, when you have this agreeable conflict avoidance, or particularly like the relationship between your agreeableness and how unusual your personality characteristics are matters. So if you've got like these high cost personality characteristics, it artificially drives up how conflict avoidant you are about them, because they are disproportionately weighed out in the balance of the relationship. You do not want that person paying full cost for those things, because you recognize from experience that they are unusual and expensive. So you have to force yourself in that sort of circumstance into this impersonal little clinical session where the two of you just kind of hash out what's going on and have this real commitment to problem solving as the spirit of that.
I got a question. If you find the magic 10%, would you expect that there'd be less need for State of the Unions once a month, or, you know, on a regular basis?
Less, but not, it does not entirely go away. So this kind of scenario that this person's describing is very, you can be very, and in fact, almost, you know, there's a little bit of a paradox where if you're very over-rewarded, you're trying to limit your cost even more, because there's some inflection point where you're over-rewarded to the point that you start walking on eggshells a little bit. And so you're even less likely to, present yourself at full cost within the relationship, because you're feeling like it's kind of a marginal deal for them. And you're really worried about losing it. So if you truly have a magic 10%, you're feeling very valued and very much valuing them, it makes it easier. But I think there are going to be sticking points in every relationship that are running into the same kind of personality issues. And this particular variant of agreeableness, I've been in beautiful, magical 10% over-rewarded relationships, and it's very difficult for me to put myself on the map as this person. I'm assuming this is a female asking this question. That's probably my egocentric bias. I don't think we were necessarily told that. It's like my dogs. You know, Motown is scared of fireworks. He's gonna freak out and bark at fireworks. He can be in a nice, quiet house where he never hears fireworks, but when he hears a loud noise and it scares him, it doesn't mean that tendency, it's in there. It's dormant. It's always there. It's just waiting to be triggered in a particular way. And I think any long-term relationship over time is going to bring all of that kind of stuff up. It's going to push you to the boundaries of your discomfort in some way.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I would say the other knuckle dragger comment that I would make would be kind of the following, which is that you do the best you can, but if the conflict is too much, it starts to drive unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And if the unhappiness is too much, then you're going to have to try another partner. So, you know, it's not necessarily solvable. In other words, you could have a lot of positives in a relationship, and you could have essentially, for all intents and purposes, the best tools for resolving the conflicts. But if the conflicts are sufficiently great, then what's going to happen is it will drive unhappiness, and that unhappiness will then, you'll just have to face it, and you're going to have to try somebody that's just as agreeable, but maybe not quite as clingy, okay, as the person described. So not easy. That person is a problematic looking piece of a jigsaw puzzle. Not that easy to find the fit on the other side.
Yeah,
and that's
such is life. You know, you need to, you know, you don't want to be like overly Disney princess romantic about it either, because this is a situation where there is room for improvement in communication through the exposure therapy of going through this process that's very uncomfortable. So, you know, mm-hmm. speaking again as somebody who has been in this situation where it serves my interests really well to you know, assert myself more than is comfortable for me. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have that experience. I have gotten better at that over time with practice, with iterative experiences where you realize, particularly in a magical 10% relationship, that you can do that and it's okay. That you can do that, you mm-hmm. can get through that conversation, and the two of you can work through something that feels at the beginning completely unworkable or like it's going to be so high cost that you're going to send the other person screaming. And you can get through it, and you have that experience, and it becomes a data point in your inference of how costly it will be to do the next time. And so it gets a little easier the next mm-hmm. time. And so you're not changing your personality. You're just getting better at a skill that doesn't come mm-hmm. very easily to you. So you can move some degree of that range, particularly mm-hmm. in a good, mutually over-rewarded relationship. But that's about the best that you can ask for.
Yeah. One last little point that comes up, and that is that it's useful when you're having those discussions to keep in mind that the right strategy is to have temporary agreements, experiments. Because if people feel like that they're trying to settle agreements of long-term, a long-term contract, then they get way more difficult to negotiate with. Okay, so so in other words, the notion is, hey, let's try this for the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, and let's just see how it feels. So that's an important point to keep in mind when any of these kind of negotiations are going down.
Yeah, that's a really good point. As the person with the liabilities too, it's important to keep that in mind, that you're not asking for anything forever. You're just asking, hey, can we try this and see if it works? And you don't feel that, you know, I'm rejecting you because I need to spend more time alone, or, you know, I don't feel like I can't get as much sleep as I need to get because you need too much togetherness, whatever it is. You're making that whole negotiation much simpler by putting a timeline on it.
Yeah. Wonderful. I like this concept of State of the Union. I may remain skeptical for a monthly State of the Union, but that's not because you're wrong, but because I just haven't tried it that often.
It's I always think of one of my very favorite Simpsons episodes of all time, which is when Homer realizes that he can work from home if he's able to make some workman's compensation claim, and he realizes for this, and so he can't believe his luck, and so he proceeds to gain a great deal of weight, and he there's many very hilarious scenes throughout this whole episode that are just probably it's going to be canceled and sent down the memory hole anytime now because it's so offensive, but the whole episode culminates with he's working from home, and his one job is to press one key on the computer to it's like this homage to energy conservation. All he has to do is press this one key to like vent the poisonous gas out of the reactor at the nuclear plant where he works. And even this is like too much work for him. So he rigs up this thing where there's like this bird, this plastic bird in water that bobs back and forth. And when it bobs, it hits the key, and then something knocks it over. And so the poisonous gas builds up. And he doesn't realize this until he's wandered back from the kitchen from getting some sandwich. And there's this very scary text on his computer screen that says, and he reads it in his Homer, you know, he's not very literate. So he's like, venting gas prevents explosion. And then he tries to push the button, and it's like too built up, and he can't do it. And the whole episode is just hilarious. I highly recommend it if people haven't seen it. But I think of State of the Union like that. You have to vent the poisonous gas to prevent the explosion. And if you're in this situation where there's like a lot of kind of simmering conflict, you do not want, if you're an agreeable person, you need to get ahead of yourself. You need to not get yourself in a situation where your resentment has built to the point. I think people who are not very agreeable don't have a very good intuitive sense of how far an agreeable person has to be chiseled and pushed before they finally squawk. But by the time an agreeable person says, hey, we need to talk about this, like I'm having an issue, they have been they've been building up poisonous gas for quite a long time. They're having a really hard time. It's really torturing them. And so even if there's nothing particularly unpleasant or conflict ridden going on in the weekly State of the Union or the monthly State of the Union, then that's fine. Then you just have breakfast together and you say, you know, hey, could you do the dishes an extra night a week or whatever? There, you know, you just have like very, very minimal conversation. But it's really necessary to institutionalize it and make it this sort of low cost ritual to protect the agreeable person.
Yes. Beautiful. God, that's beautiful.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Nate is as a resident disagreeable.
Yeah.
Well, here's kind of my thoughts on it. So I had a couple of friends that I don't want to share their identities, but we were actually talking about relationships, and we were talking about relationships and this idea. They didn't call it the State of the Union, but we were all talking about the different relationship, like romantic relationship we've had, and one of the friends was saying, "Oh yeah, do you guys like check in with your partner like every so often? Just say, hey, this may bother me or this and that." And both of us were like, no, we've never had anything like that with any partners. We just, if we don't like them, or if we like them enough, like we'll take it and we'll tolerate it. It's no big deal. And then if there's something, you know, that's part of who they are, like that's exactly who they are. And we're not going to try to change them. And if it turns out it's really egregious, then they're not the right person and that's it. And so, we ended up talking separately essentially assuming that this State of the Union was just a tool for disagreeable people to just chisel away and get more and more what they want every month or every so often. So that's just my consternation. I mean, my disagreement with it. It's maybe a misunderstanding, this concept of State of the Union, but the checking in, you know, with the partner, that's kind of how I perceived it.
No, I think I think Jen has really put her finger on something, that this is a super useful institutionalized process that protects the hyper agreeable. Mm-hmm. And or the person who may be a little on eggshells because they're feeling a little too overrewarded, but they're also feeling the conflicts and they've got some unhappiness. So beautiful. Great stuff, Jen. Just beautiful. Notice she's more sophisticated at relationship stuff than I am, because I'm like, it sounds like it's not working. Get out. but no, that's all just beautiful. Great stuff.
Yeah, I do have to we got to give John Gottman some credit for that phrase. You know, I've heard other people call it that. I don't know if he invented that, but he's definitely the one who introduced State of the Union into the lexicon. And we've recommended him before, and I don't unreservedly recommend him, but I do think he's more... Yeah, it was more good than bad in his work. He's got like a bunch of sticky kind of books, like the 7 Secrets to a Happy Marriage and all this kind of stuff.
Sure, that's what sells.
He's a lot of his analysis is correlation, not causation. So when he's talking about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, so, you know, I contempt, stonewalling, criticism and defensiveness. So these are things where if he sees that in an interaction with couples, he's going to be like, oh no, this is on a bad path. This isn't going to, well, of course, of course that's what's going to happen. You're looking at a patient with a giant tumor and saying, hey, I think you've got cancer. I think you've got a problem here. You're not really making much of a prediction. You're just looking at the symptoms. So, but a lot of the tools are quite useful, especially if you start using them early and often in a relationship before things get really dire.
Yeah. I love the Homer story.
Oh my God,
perfect.
That episode is so good. There's one where there's one scene where he's the neighbor kids are looking through the window to just, you know, gawk at him because they can't believe he's just like he's just hanging around the house in his moo-moo. One of the kids is like poking him with a stick through the window, and one of Bart's friends says, "Hey, buddy, what do you got a fridge too far?" It's such a great episode. And of course the whole thing culminates in him saving the day with his his enormous size. So it's actually like the fact that he has created the catastrophe through his avoidant energy conservation. It turns out that the whole thing would have been much more a disaster if not for the fact that he's enormously fat and can save the day in a very specific way. So it all works out. Yep. Springfield,
yep, good.
Springfield is not wiped from the map, but in a catalog of many wonderful episodes, that one really gets to a lot of the heart of human nature, and it manages to be very sweet and ridiculous at the same time.
Fabulous. All right.
Our next question.
Dear
doctors, I have a curiosity from real life personal experience. I'm a female in my mid-20s as my girlfriends. We differ physically, some prettier than others, but we all get approached both for casual mating and pair bonds. But I have this one specific girlfriend who seems to be different because she only attracts pair bonds. She has never gotten a casual mating approach, not that I can ever remember. She gets approached by all fine, decent, good-looking, intelligent guys who all really love her. She's average-looking, yet thin, long-haired, and very intelligent, too. She gets in a stable, monogamous relationship with one, stays with him for 2, 3, 4 years, saying she really, really loves him, and then abruptly dumps him, moving to the next one. She seems to always have another one ready, waiting in line. The guys get dumped periodically and get sick and depressed. She's kind of unaware of the cycle process, and she always announces the new relationship by saying, "I knew it was going to happen. I knew it would end. I would get with him. I knew in the end I would get with him," with each of them. She's in her mid-20s too, and has already changed many. Considerations on this? I'm more curious about how she can be so lucky to always find good pair bonds as to why she acts like this. It's her life. Maybe she's very open to new experiences, but she's average, agreeable, and more on the stable, conscientious side, and slightly extroverted.
Well, maybe I'll just start to react, and then Jen, you can clean it up afterwards. After I make a mess of it. First of all, descriptions like this I always had this creepy feeling that I'm being walked down a pathway of essentially bad reporting of the evidence.
Yeah, selection bias.
I believe in ESP because there was a time when this and that happened, and then another time when it couldn't possibly have been the case because I hadn't even been over there yet. And then, okay, it's like, yeah, well, how do I know that any of this is true? And so this is, I'm immediately suspicious when I hear a story. So when I listen to that, the story as it's being told, supposedly this person's been through several of these things that are 2 to 4 years, and yet she's in her mid-20s, for God's sakes. Let's do the math. Okay, this thing falls apart literally before we're through a paragraph as a concept. So so what we're really seeing is if this young lady's been through how many partners from 2 to 4 years that were pair bonders, and she's in her mid-20s, how many could it possibly be? 3? 5? Okay, so if it's 5, we're going to have to retell the story because that would take us back to age 15. So at any rate, all these partners supposedly are good looking, pleasant, et cetera. And by the way, how on earth would you ever know if she gets approached for casual mating or not?
Yeah.
Can you tell?
That was the first thing to occur to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not there for everybody that ever approaches her. And the people that are approaching her, they don't know what they're approaching her for. So this is all just sort of a whole pile of assumptions. As Jen would say, we got some egocentric bias sitting inside whoever's asking these questions. I would also say that if she has a bunch of attractive young men treating her really well, they're always crazy about her, and she winds up being the person who dumps, and this happened, I don't know, 3 times, whatever it is. The truth of the matter is, she's probably more attractive than you're giving her credit for. If she has that kind of market power. So anyway, I can't possibly comment on this because further, because the truth is we're talking about a young person in her 20s that's been through 3, 4, 5 moderately long-term relationships since age 18. I mean, how long could they be? And so she may very well play a common female strategy, i.e. have a man on plan B before you dump the guy that you're with. Super common female strategy. That's nothing new under the sun. She gets rid of one. She gets rid of him easily. Why? Because she's already been mentally out of it with him for the last 4 months. And since ever she met the better prospect that she's been warming up and qualifying for a while. And then when she dumps Harry, she goes with Tom. No problem. That's no surprise strategy at all. So I don't think that we have any mystery here at all. We just have someone who probably by the nature of her presentation and advertisement does not advertise that she is looking at casual mating strategy, doesn't show a lot of skin, doesn't wear a lot of tight clothes, doesn't wear a lot of dramatic makeup, doesn't have her hair very fluffy, etc., not wearing high heels that are very high. In other words, we have someone that's advertising a conservatism and therefore attracts males who are essentially their best foot forward in seeking a female is to be selling pair bond strategy as opposed to casual mating strategy. That's why. So I don't think there's any, you will get to a large extent what it is that you're advertising for. And so obviously this winds up being a dilemma inside the female's head, because the female is generally not playing one strategy or the other. She's a Stone Age creature that's splitting the difference. And it depends on which time of the month it is, what she's playing. We know this. Okay, so we've got good evidence that females, certainly in bars, show more square inches of skin when they're more fertile, i.e. they're hotter to trot for casual mating at those junctures. And this is unconscious, by the way. So you can test it. They don't know where they are on their cycle. But then if you actually run a correlation coefficient on square inches of skin and where they are in their cycle, voila, we observe the casual mating strategy becoming more prominent. So anyway, have I missed anything, Jen? What are you?
I'm just thinking about all those times I was ovulating sitting in bars with fluffy hair. It all makes sense. My 20s are suddenly, it's like this, I hear harps playing music. It's like,
no, it's more like a kaleidoscope when it clicks in and you can see it all clearly.
Now, this is totally my response is that, you know, I think within female friendship circles, we often think we know our friends better than we really do. And we think we know, you know, their patterns really, really well. We don't know the secret life of our friends as well as we think we do a lot of the time. So this strikes me totally as what Doug is saying. You know, she's got them lined up before they appear on the scene when you're getting your first glance at them. And so the little speech that she's making about, I knew it was going to happen and I was going to wind up with this guy in the end. It's because she's been, you know, she has been having, for lack of a better or more precise term, an emotional affair, if not a physical affair, with that new candidate for some time. So I don't know where this pool of guys is coming from, if everybody's in college or if this is a shared work pool or if she's picking them up online or wherever she's grabbing them. They are not just coming on the scene to arrive as a fully formed pair bond out of nowhere. She's been curating that relationship for a while, and you don't know about it because she's not going to go public about it until she's sure, until she's ready to do this serial monogamy thing, which is very, very, very mm-hmm. typical. You're having a perception of a pattern that is probably not as much of a pattern as you think it is, as Doug is saying, and girls are really good at hiding their secrets even from their best friends. I would say no huge mystery here either. And to the point with casual mating, I mean, is this sort of a question of you're all at bars together and everybody's getting hit on, but she's not? Or are you just observing that she does not report casual mating interactions? Because, you know, she might get some interest, but she's sufficiently cool to any of that interest that it doesn't look like a casual mating interaction to anybody who's paying attention. And if she's not presenting herself with all of that fluffy hair and all of those square inches of skin, then you're just not getting the cues to even notice it when it does happen. So, you know, I'm sure she has guys strike up conversations with her on buses and in lines at movies and all of the sort of things that are casual mating strategies, but don't look like something that you would necessarily see in a movie. It's just a guy doing a quick little market test. So I would be surprised if she's, you know, has the high mate value that we know that she does from the serial monogamy, if she doesn't have those kinds of experience. But it's probably effectively invisible to you.
Grand. All right.
Okay, our next question. Dear doctors, I'm 7 years out of graduate school. Since then, my friends from school have naturally taken different career paths. One friend has become a life and wellness coach, primarily through social media. She enjoys what she does, makes a livable living, and creates value in her clients' lives. Yet, when our friends group occasionally mentions this friend, everyone seems to disapprove of what she's doing business-wise. In fact, all of us have unfollowed her on social media because we can't stand to watch her content. She gives advice on nutrition, makes motivational videos, and sells coaching sessions to women. And for some reason, it all comes off as disingenuous, scammy, and distorted. I have no intention of changing her or her business. What I'm curious about is, why do we feel disgust whenever she comes up in conversation? There's no issue whenever she and I hang out in person. We always have a good time. But why am I so turned off by her internet presence and the way she makes money? Could it be that I think she's claiming unearned status? Or could it be that I see the online coach version of her as deceiving and therefore a threat to the village?
Well, what comes to mind for you, Jen?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, in this kind of case, you're picking up on the hypocrisy. And there is, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily a threat to the village that you're seeing the difference between how she's presenting herself to one group and, you know, at odds with how she presents herself elsewhere. It's not necessarily threatening, but it is zero sum with your potential status. So I guess we could call it threatening if we wanted to, but it's competitive. She's misrepresenting her value. And there's only so much value to go around in the village. And even if you're not necessarily in exactly the same space, you're in principle, you are competing for the esteem of the same general population, certainly the same mates, you know, the same, as far as your nervous system is concerned, the same pantheon of people who are paying attention in the village community. So you're irritated because she's getting away with something and she's stealing some status that doesn't belong to her. And you feel this kind of urge to make people aware of the fact that this is not truthful and that she's chiseling away your potential esteem, your potential value, your potential spoils, and that she wouldn't have been able to get away with this in the Stone Age. There wasn't an ability to cultivate an online persona that was completely at odds with what people knew was true about you. So we live in this crazy modern environment where we can occupy this facade space all the time. And, you know, torture other people online with it. Everybody who thinks that Instagram personalities are real. I mean, I talk to people all the time who are kind of just can't help but make that inference. And this is just not the case in the Stone Age at all. I mean, everybody knows exactly who you are. They know exactly what you're about. They know exactly what talents you have. They're not going to buy any kind of exaggerated story of your authority or your ability to perform miracles in the village. They know better. And even if you could get away with it for some short period of time, the truth is going to come out pretty quickly. So I think you're feeling that urge that you would have to, you know, ring the bell and inform the people of the lies that are taking place, and you can't do that in the modern environment without causing a lot of social problems and interpersonal difficulties. And it's irritating. I have been in this situation. I had a friendship end over it because I was with this I had this incredibly hypocritical roommate who was just this grandstanding social media presence about, you know, just took every opportunity to get to sort of appropriate this very lecturing tone about how everyone needed to get in line with certain political beliefs, and it was very important that we all come together and we all do this, and we need. And I was watching her, you know, mostly hang around the house in a pair of pajamas with monkeys on them eating potato chips most of the time. And I was like, it made me crazy to look at that kind of hypocrisy. And it sounds like you're in a very similar situation. And that was completely what was bothering me in that case. I'm like, she is getting away with shit that she should not be getting away with, and somebody needs to inform everybody in the community so they don't give her more Stone Age currency than she is owed. So I think that's basically what's going on. But Doug, chime in.
Yeah. So yeah, the questioner is sort of avoiding the heart of what Jen is explaining, which is that it's hitting your own stress about that this woman is nudging ahead of the pack, and that's your pack that she's nudging her way ahead of. And so if you're angry, almost always about unfairness to you. Okay. It can be about unfairness to other people. That's true. But usually it's unfairness to you. So when it comes to this little college group, it's unfairness to the people in the group. That's what they're feeling. Okay, so, and unfair how? How on earth is this woman being unfair? Well, she's if she's got an online presence and she's got a little celebrity, well, from some perspective, she would look fancier than the rest of you who are just working at regular jobs that, you know, no matter how good the job is with the resume, hey, you're not like a quote celebrity, of some fashion. So that there is a potential inference from such things that essentially gaining any kind of celebrity is essentially a fitness indicator, and so that it has hierarchical legitimacy, and it has a little bit. Just because it's difficult and it takes some push and it takes something, looks, brains, personality, luck, content of some kind. In other words, something is required in order to have some kind of success in any sort of celebrity fashion. However, there's slop all over the place, and it is in no way a great fitness indicator at all, but it is above zero as a fitness indicator. So if you have a little group of college friends and everybody's quietly working their way in their life in a normal fashion, and then one of them is actually seeking celebrity while the other ones are not and is achieving it, there can be that little clanging anxiety that she's sticking her nose in front of the rest of you with respect to fitness indicators. And that can feel unfair, particularly when you recognize all the things Jen's talking about, like there's some hypocrisy, or there's some salesmanship, there's some sleazy, you know, activities that need to be done in order for her to compete with the other sleazy people. You know, if you ever wondered why everybody has to overpromise and underdeliver, it's because everybody else is overpromising and underdelivering. So you have to overpromise more than they do. I mean, this is the process of what's going on, and it goes online with respect to coaching type stuff, psychobabble type of stuff, health type of stuff, all kinds of things, particularly in sort of the online world. So it'd be no surprise that there would be, she's probably an attractive person, attractive, personable, extroverted, has a presence, and therefore if she's surviving and getting anybody to buy any of her wares, she's got some capability in front of a camera. And so that's probably, you know, pinging the circuits of people who inherently feel essentially some degree of competitiveness with her. And that's, I would feel that. Like I can remember a guy in grad school. He was very good looking guy. And he...
Why do I feel like there's going to be a basketball story involved?
Actually, he was a fine basketball player. So the... but he was... As another fellow student who was very bright of mine said, you know, our friend J.A., or his initials, says, you know, with his dissertation was known to have accounted for more than 100% of the variance. Which means the J.A. was pretty smart, but he wasn't that smart. Okay. Well, he was very personable, handsome, well-spoken, and he was, you know, sort of the coolest guy in the department. And he got a pretty decent little professorial job. And a few years later, I saw the American Psychologist started doing something for the first time, probably in 1992. Okay, we'd have to go back and look. But there was a point right around then when they started having pictures of the people who wrote the articles in the American Psychologist. Hmm. American Psychologist is, in fact, the flagship journal of psychology in the world. So the even though, I mean, it thinks so, the truth is it should be like the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology is, you know, better. But the point is that from the standpoint of cachet and really scientific care, if you know, in spite of, you know, probably theoretical obtuseness, the American Psychologist is the most prestigious journal in the world of psychology. And lo and behold, I was flipping through there and I see J.A.'s picture and he wrote an article and he got it in the American Psychologist. And I'm thinking, that's just like irritating to me. I know he's not that smart. And there he is, handsome as hell. You know, and he actually wrote, he actually wasn't bad. It wasn't actually bad what he wrote, but it, you know, it was nothing earth-shattering. He certainly didn't deserve the glory and adulation that I deserved even then, and I hadn't written anything.
It's the principle of the thing.
That's totally the principle of the thing. So this is where we stand. The principle of the thing is, I think we understand the group's frustration.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. All right.
All right. I think that concludes all the questions for today. Thank you guys for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Fabulous. Jen, it was a dream listening to you, as always.
You're very kind. All of our listeners can complete their drinking game for the unearned compliments, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
No way. All right. All right, Nathan. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good night, everybody.
All right. Good night.
Gotcha. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.